good morning. Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey. I am Mike Causey, and our guest today is John Grobe. He is a former federal worker and now a longtime federal retirement or federal benefits expert, not just retirement. And John is here in D.C. doing some training. He normally, you're based in Chicago, John, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And the accent is sort of a giveaway, but we hadn't heard from you yet. Anyhow, glad to have you with us today. And listen, the cheat sheet that you wrote out for me is so good, I think I could leave the studio and just let you go at it. So would you tell us what you're going to talk about and then talk about it?
Sure. What I'm going to talk about today, and this may roll over into another show at some time, is common misconceptions that federal employees have about their benefits. Our benefits, of course, being created by Congress, are more confusing than they need to be. And there's a lot of ways that our benefits differ from benefits people have in the private sector, and CSRS benefits differ from FERS benefits, and so on. So I came up with a list of roughly 14 common misconceptions. And today I think we will handle some of the most common. But I just want to run through all 14 of them before we get going.
Oh, and John, can I interrupt you before we get going here? I've talked to other benefits experts who train government workers and do mid-career seminars and people who are within 5 years of retiring, and they all say that most of the crowds are very good, but many people are quite ignorant of some of the benefits they have and the value of benefits they have. Is that your feeling?
I think so. I think there are a lot of benefits people don't think of, and there are little arcane parts of federal benefits that people overlook. It is not surprising for me to run into someone who thinks that because they are contributing to the Thrift Savings Plan, they're not allowed to contribute to an IRA. Nothing further from the case there. There are some people who aren't aware of the 5-year rule for carrying federal employee health benefits into retirement. And I have actually run into a person or two who doesn't realize federal employees have a pension. I've seen FERS employees who think that all they will be entitled to is Social Security and the Thrift Savings Plan. Now, having said that, most people are pretty well informed. They listen to shows like yours or go to your website or any of the other numerous websites out there, most of which begin with the word federal, and they stay on top of things.
Well, you know, you mentioned the magic word, the 5-year rule, and I think a lot of people are not aware of this. In fact, I know they're not, because everybody in this business has run into somebody who can't retire because they weren't aware of this rule. And the rule, in short, is that in order to carry federal health insurance into retirement, you must have it for the 5 years preceding retirement. And that's a big deal in a place like Washington, where you have mixed marriages, if you will, a Fed and a non-Fed. And maybe the husband or wife is piggybacking on the non-federal spouse's health plan because it's better or lower deductibles or something. But in retirement, nothing beats the federal health plan. And so you want to be sure that the 5 years before you retire, you are enrolled in a federal health plan. Now, you can get a cheap one, get one with very low premiums, but establish your eligibility, correct?
That is correct. You want to have been enrolled in an FEHB plan for the 5 years immediately preceding retirement. Now, when we get to that misconception, we will also talk about the fact that if you're married to another Fed, you can piggyback on their enrollment.
Sure.
You do not have to have been enrolled in a plan in your name at all, because being covered as a family member on the FEHB plan of your federally employed spouse counts for that 5-year period.
Okay. Well, what's some other things on your checklist, John?
Well, one I have, and this might be going back more to the CSRS days, but there was this discussion that there's a magic 85 formula for being eligible to retire. Your age and length of service had to add up to the age of 85 in order for you to retire, and that's not the case. Other common misconceptions that the TSP early withdrawal penalty will stick with you up until you're 59 and a half. That is not true. That's an IRA rule, not a TSP rule. Another one, you have to have sick leave in even month increments in order for it to count in your retirement computation. Others about FEHB, you have to be enrolled in the same FEHB plan for 5 years. Not true. Your spouse must have been enrolled in FEHB for the 5 years. Not true. Some people think their retirement contributions, the amount of money they spent on their pension, the payroll deductions, have something to do with how their pension is computed. That's not the case either. And there's a misconception that a lot of feds don't have, but people they work with, like financial planners and so on, do. And that is that our pension has a lump sum distribution and our pension will end at some time. Well, yes, it ends, but it ends just immediately after you take your last breath.
Yeah.
Some people think FEHB
Excuse me, and you can provide a survivor annuity too, so it can,
yes.
go on and on.
Absolutely.
I think the last Civil War survivor, a surviving widow, died about 6 years ago. The war ended in 1865. This old veteran married a much younger woman, and so some of these benefits can be almost forever.
Yeah, I was thinking it would have had to have been an awfully
young
spouse.
Yeah, child bride.
Yes, for sure. I remember when I was growing up, you'd hear about the neighborhood's last Civil War veteran and so on, but I guess now the last survivor's gone. I bet you there's a lot of Spanish-American War ones
Absolutely.
Out there, though.
Absolutely.
Some people think FEHB costs increase after retirement, only if you work for a couple agencies that provide extra contributions would that be the case. Some folks think that the money you get from your pension will count against the Social Security earnings test. A lot of people like to believe that the government is going to sweeten the pot in buyouts. Though there's a little bit of thought about that now, it's not the case yet. Some folks think you need an open season to increase your FEGLI enrollment. You can do that outside of an open season.
FEGLI being life insurance.
Federal Employees Group Life Insurance. Those of us who work in the benefits area, sometimes we think that everyone understands the same acronyms we do, and that's certainly not the case. That's a misconception on my part.
I've had to be trilingual, speaking media language, governmentese, and normal mid-Atlantic English.
Yeah, absolutely. I do the Midwestern English with all the Chicago mispronunciations, so I'll apologize in advance for dropping G's at the end
friends
of words.
Friends, Dennis, friends will love you.
And all of that stuff. So, you know, some people don't realize there is a connection between electing a survivor benefit for a spouse and that spouse's ability to collect FEHB after the employee's death. And some folks think a retiree cannot count military time towards both military and civilian retirement. Now, in some instances, it makes no sense to do so, but in other instances, it does.
Yeah. Let me back up to something you said earlier about providing a survivor annuity for a spouse. I've known cases where you have a man and a woman, they're long married, both have very, very good jobs in government, both have a long time in the government, both have health insurance coverage. I mean, they're fixed for life as far as retirement goes. And they sit down and crunch the numbers and find that sometimes there's no need to leave a survivor benefit. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true in some cases. When I'm doing retirement classes and I talk about the question, we kind of go through a decision tree on the question, should you or shouldn't you elect a survivor benefit? I tell the people in the class that the correct answer is it depends. It depends is not a cop-out when you're talking to a bunch of people, all of whom have different situations.
Okay, we need to take a very short break here. We'll be right back and talking with John Grobe. He's a federal benefits expert. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Hey, Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with John Grove. He's come all the way to D.C. from Chicago, where he is based, and he's doing some training in some federal agencies here, which he does from time to time, and we always try to catch him when he's in town. John, I'm looking here. I have a copy of The Answer Book on Your Federal Employee Benefits. The author is John Grove. That would be you, and it's put out by LRP. What's in this book?
Well, this book was designed to answer a lot of questions. It's almost like it answers the question, what do I do when I'm hired? What do I do when I'm looking for a promotion? What do I do if I get divorced? What do I do when I'm ready to retire? It looks at all of your federal benefits from the perspective of different points in your life and in your federal career. It looks at all the different kinds of insurance. It looks at FEHB, Social Security, and other areas that would be important to federal employees when they are navigating their federal career. I wrote it last year, and a second edition has recently come out with a few changes in it. Certainly changes regarding the last-minute Social Security changes Congress rammed through towards the end of the year, and all new numbers for the numbers that were changed due to inflation and other things.
The federal long-term care insurance program, the premiums are going up dramatically starting November 1, and they increase from The increase is significant. They don't want to talk about it, but it's in for many people, the average person, the premium is going to go up $111 a month. That's a monthly increase, and they say this is because people are living longer, and when they're in their final 3, 4, 5 years, they tend to be in such bad shape that they need home health care or need to go into a facility, and that's where long-term care comes in. What do you think about long-term care?
I have to give you my favorite answer, mm-hmm. and that is it depends.
Yeah.
Yes. I myself tend to be cautious when I'm doing financial planning. And if you're thinking of long-term care coverage, it's insurance. You want to do a risk analysis. How likely is it that something will happen, and how catastrophic will it be for me financially if that does indeed happen? So what we're looking at in terms of long-term care is how likely will it be that I actually need long-term care for an extended period of time. And when we're looking at the how catastrophic part, it's do I have a large enough net worth to pay for long-term care on my own, or is this something I need to insure against? John Hancock's the underwriter for the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance
Correct.
Program. They were a joint underwriter with MetLife in the first contract period. They were by themselves the second contract period, and they are by themselves once again. I found it interesting. I got an OPM Benefits Administration letter Monday, and it talks about the competitive process where they only had one bidder,
exactly.
who happened to be John Hancock. Yeah. But John Hancock will tell us that we have a 70% chance of using their insurance.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to think about is their insurance will kick in on your 91st day of long-term care. So all they're really telling me is I have a 70% chance of needing 91 days of long-term care insurance. Now, if you were to go to a bookstore and get a book by any of the good financial writers, there's a couple ladies, I humorously refer to them as the queens of cheap. You've got Susie Orman,
yeah.
and you've got Washington, D.C.'s own Michelle Singletary,
yeah.
and both of them focus rightly on frugality and thrift as the way to get the money that you can then invest and have grow for your retirement. Well, I like reading books by Susie and Michelle, and they tend to say that your need for extended long-term care, 2, 3, or more years, is maybe only 10 to 15%. But I don't know that individuals should believe either John Hancock or Susie and Michelle,
mm-hmm.
because each one of us is different.
Yeah.
When I was thinking about long-term care insurance for myself, I looked back at my parents' generation, everything I knew about generations before that. My mother's side of the family lives a real long time, my dad's side only lived a relatively long time, which meant there was more of a need for long-term care, or what passed for long-term care back in those days, than perhaps someone whose ancestors didn't live as long. I then looked at how catastrophic would it be? Would the costs of long-term care drain my nest egg? And I thought, well, if I need a lot of it, it might. So being cautious, I purchased long-term care insurance. Now, this was just a little bit before the feds offered their policy, so I purchased it outside. And I can tell you that outside private policies, they also raise premiums every time there's a new contract period. This is kind of the way it is with long-term care, and they all give the same reasons that we've been hearing from John Hancock about the fact that people are living longer,
morbidity and mortality,
care for longer. Yeah. And I think something they haven't said, any of the insurance companies, is low interest rates have something to do with it, because insurance companies don't take the money you give them and put it in a shoebox in a closet. They invest it, and they hope that the return they receive will be enough for them to pay promised benefits.
They said that on our July 21st radio show, and they mentioned the low interest rates. I think looking around you, any of us, just look around you. Back in the day, long-term care was your daughter coming to take care of you, or you moving in with a daughter-in-law or something like that. And in fact, somebody once said, be kind to your daughter-in-law because she'll pick your nursing home. My mother was a retired Fed. She got long-term care insurance on the outside, as you did, and as for that matter, as I did. And she was healthy all her life. In the last couple of years, dementia hit. It was horrible for her. It could have been horrible for us, the family, except she had Social Security, she had the federal health insurance, and she had long-term care insurance. And that's when I first understood the term that getting long-term care insurance is a gift to your kids.
It is. It is. And I have seen, back when the first long-term care contract came out, I was asked by some people in one of my retirement classes if it would make sense for them to pool with their siblings and get it for their parents. And it certainly would. You have a group of siblings, because with our federal long-term care insurance, it's not just for the employee. They have a definition they call the federal family, and where anyone who meets this definition can apply, and that is the federal employee, their spouse or partner, their adult children, their parents, their parents-in-law, and their step-parents. Now, who knows? They may have all three, parents, parents-in-law, and step-parents.
Well, you know, like so many brilliant ideas, that's incredibly simple. If you have a couple of brothers or a couple of sisters or something, and it could even be cousins who are devoted to a family member or a grandparent, but let them pay the monthly premium, figure it out somehow. I always think people have homeowners insurance. They don't want their house to blow away in this tornado, but it could. People have fire insurance. Most of us don't want to see our house burn to the ground, but we have it. You have auto insurance. You have life insurance. Nobody wants to die. But yet when it comes to long-term care insurance, many people are afraid the premiums will be wasted. That is, that they won't have to use it. And that in itself is a great good bit of luck.
Yeah, your example of fire insurance is a great one. Did I waste my money if my house didn't burn down? Insurance is basically protection, at least a lot of it is, protection against catastrophic expenses. And with the costs of long-term care, those expenses can be catastrophic. They can be quite high.
Okay, John, take a short break here. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey, and glad to have you with us today. My guest is federal benefits expert John Grobe, based out of Chicago. He is himself a former Fed, worked for the Postal Service, and among other places, and you have sort of mastered this. You have written this second edition of the answer book for your federal employee benefits. It's by LRP Publications. John, where can people get this book?
They can go on to the LRP Publications website. LRP has a lot of different books. Most of them are on topics that human resource and EEO professionals would be interested in. This is one of the books, though, that they have that really is a good book for every single federal employee. It doesn't get into technical legal matters. It's just basically, what do I do with my federal retirement and benefits at different stages of my career, and what are some of the things of which I need to be aware?
That's LRP, Lima, Romeo, Papa.
Yes, it is.
And okay, very good. John, we spent the first part of the show talking, I think, in very interesting generalities, everything from long-term care insurance to myths about the civil service. We didn't really get to what the structure that you had looked at, so let's do that right now.
Okay, I just want to address perhaps a few of the more prevalent myths that we need to disabuse people of. One of them is that there is an early withdrawal penalty on anything you take out of the thrift savings plan before you reach the age of 59 and a half. Now, the 59 and a half early withdrawal penalty rule is for IRAs, and the I, of course, stands for individual. The TSP is an employer-sponsored plan, and employer-sponsored plans have different rules. If you retire or separate, I should probably use that word, you don't have to retire. If you separate in the year in which you reach 55 or later, there is no early withdrawal penalty on anything you take out of the TSP. And there is a new, began the first of this year, exception that applies to special category employees, law enforcement officers, firefighters, Customs and Border Protection officers, and there are several others, including but not limited to nuclear materials couriers. People who are in those special categories will not face an early withdrawal penalty if they separate and withdraw the money from their TSP in the year in which they attain 50 or later. So we feds, out of our employer-sponsored plan, can take money out, avoiding the penalty earlier. This was just passed in late 2015, and it was effective the beginning of this year for law enforcement officers, firefighters, and so on.
Yeah, nuclear couriers, that's a chilling occupation.
I would think so.
I think they should be able to do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, I picture somebody on a train with a briefcase handcuffed to their wrist.
Right, or driving a truck somewhere.
Yeah,
but go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that would be a suicide jockey if you're driving a truck full of nuclear materials. A few misconceptions about the FEHB and the five-year rule. The requirement is solely that the employee be enrolled in the FEHB and the program. One, they do not have to be in the same plan for that whole period of time. Their spouse, there's another misconception. A lot of people think their spouse has to be on their FEHB plan for the 5 years before they retire. Well, that's not true either. Your spouse doesn't even have to be on the FEHB plan at the time you retire. If I have a spouse who's working for a private sector company where they have better insurance than I do as a Fed, although they lose it at retirement, as long as I'm still alive, I just need to be able to fog a mirror, and my spouse retires, loses her health insurance, I can bring her on my FEHB then and there as a qualifying life event.
And excuse me, a lot of people refer to this as having insurance so that you can have insurance. And that is, you don't need it but except to meet the five-year rule. So what you do is you find the least expensive plan in the program, you know, one that has minimal premiums, get its lowest option, and enroll in it and stay in it if you like, or in the next open season, if you find a lower premium plan, jump over to that. But as long as you're covered within the federal program, that qualifies you for the five-year rule.
Right, yes. If I wanted to ride on the tailcoat of my wife's better private sector plan, I would just, as you say, need to have some FEHB coverage there. But my spouse doesn't need to be on my plan even before I retire. They just need to be on it before I die.
But John, excuse me, just again, you and I think we're both wearing belts and suspenders. You know, we both bought long-term and care insurance years before it was available in government. I bought mine as a Washington Post, and I bought it young. People said, you're too young. Well, who knows? You know, you can be hit by a bus at any age or whatnot. But this idea of waiting, as you say, until the last breath, what if you expire and the spouse is not covered? I mean, wouldn't it pay, particularly as you get older, to get a very inexpensive family plan?
Yeah, if I expire and my spouse is not covered on my FEHB, this is assuming I am employed.
Yeah.
Well, whether I'm employed or not, if my spouse is not covered, they will not be able to continue.
Okay.
That is something to consider. And, of course, neither you nor I know the day we're going to die. That's the wild card of financial planning. Yeah, fortunately, if I found out it was tomorrow, I might be depressed. Yeah. But if I found out I was going to live to 105 and not be very healthy, I would be easily as depressed.
Yeah.
So it's good we don't know some things.
Yep.
So with FEHB, again, for the five-year rule, if you are married to another federal employee and you are carried on that federal employee's FEHB as a family member, that counts towards the five-year rule. You could have a Fed who never, ever had FEHB in their own name, but because they were carried as a family member on their federally employed spouse's insurance, they would still be entitled to FEHB in retirement. And another thing for retired military, TRICARE counts towards the five-year rule as long as the employee is on an FEHB plan as of their final day of work. So TRICARE can count for it as well. Several little wrinkles there with FEHB.
Well, and I think some people, at least in my view, some people focus so much on saving money that they can miss out on a benefit, maybe a lifelong benefit that they may need or they are definitely going to need, and they're focusing on saving a few bucks here and there. It's going to be interesting to see how the new Self Plus One health insurance plan plays out when we have the second open season when it's available, because this year a lot of people were surprised that the Self Plus One plans for 2016 were no cheaper than the family plans. In some cases, they cost more. Well, it's guesswork, and it's going to depend on the health and the age of people who join these. If they have a bad experience with them, for instance, if a lot of older married retirees move into the Self Plus One, that's going to raise the premiums down the road. So we don't know, but it's the kind of thing people were focusing on, I think, maybe to the detriment of their actual coverage.
I think a lot of us, and I would probably have to put myself in that category, thought Self Plus One would be less expensive. So imagine my surprise that my wife and I are each on Self Only. Our two Self Onlys together are cheaper than the Self Plus One.
Right. Yeah. Well, Walton Francis, who's probably the world's leading authority on that, and David Snell at the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, they both said it's probably not going to make much difference. Probably won't be even worth changing in many cases. And of those that did change, it depends on whether they were young, healthy couples or older, sicker couples, and that will determine the future premiums for this.
And I think a lot of people are thinking it will be older couples,
people
who had family insurance until their children grew up, left the house, and were no longer considered children under the Affordable Care Act's definition of child.
What fascinates me is that each year the government spends millions of dollars publicizing this, getting the information to employees, subscribing to services for them, and yet year after year after year, although as many as 20 to 40% of the people should change plans for one reason or another, only 6% do. It strikes me as more education is needed out there.
More education or a simpler FEHB. Yeah. I think one reason a lot of people don't look at the plans is something that we used to call analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
If I've got, you know, the nationwide fee-for-service plans and a half a dozen HMOs in my area, do I want to spend a ton of time pouring through that to save myself $10 a month?
You find that in financial planning, too. The more 401k options you have, the more likely people are to do nothing. Listen, well, thank you very much, John Grobe, for being here. Great show. We'll have you back, and thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
When we come back, TRICARE's Deputy Director, Captain Edward Simmer, joins me here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm with Lauren Larson by my side, my trusty producer. And our guest is Captain Edward Simmer. He is the Deputy Director for the TRICARE Health Plan, which is a big, big deal in the military terms. And Captain, I won't read your resume. It is so long and so impressive, but you're a 26-year veteran of the United States Navy, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. So I think you must like it here.
I do.
Okay.
Proud to be a sailor.
Listen, we've read over as much as we can about the changes that are coming up with the TRICARE program, and Lauren and I concluded we don't know very much about it, so we're sort of putty in your hands. Is there kind of an overview you can give us as to what these changes, when they're going to happen, what they're going to mean to the average person that's covered?
Yes, absolutely. TRICARE basically covers 9.4 million people who are either active duty service members, retired service members, or their families. So it's a large responsibility. We take care of people all the way around the world. And, we have a number of things going right now. We do have, and you may have seen in the news, that we just were in the process of awarding new contracts for the medical care that we provide here within the United States. Our system of care has two parts. It has what we call the direct care system, where we provide care through military hospitals like Walter Reed or Fort Belvoir here in the D.C. area. We also then, for care that we can't provide at a military treatment facility, we augment that with care in what we call the purchased care system, which is where we go out and we pay civilian doctors and nurses and hospitals to take care of our folks. And we just put out new contracts to do that. I can tell you that we did announce the successful bidders for those, but as often the case with very large government contracts, and in fact these medical contracts are the largest single contracts in the Department of Defense, there has been a protest filed. And basically what a protest means is that an unsuccessful bidder is challenging the result and wants to take a second look. Those go through GAO. And basically once that protest is filed, there's a stop work order. We cannot move forward on new contracts until those protests are resolved. Generally that happens within about 100 days. The protests were filed last week, so figure that we should have an answer by about mid-November. We are convinced that we followed the source selection and contract award processes very closely, that we actually spent more than a year considering these proposals. So we think we did a very thorough job. And again, these bid protests are not unusual, but we really can't say too much about the new contracts until those things are resolved. Having said that, we're certainly not just standing still. We're still doing lots of things in TRICARE, making it better. We've done a couple of things here lately. One is that we have improved access to care by making it easier for people to use urgent care. Urgent care is the kind of care where, if you have an earache, you have an ankle sprain, something like that, that really shouldn't wait until the next day when your primary care clinic is open, but doesn't need an emergency room necessarily either. It used to be that for urgent care, you had to go and get permission either through the nurse advice line, which I'll talk about in a moment, or from your primary care doctor before you went. That was kind of an arduous process for folks. We wanted to make that easier. So we have now said that twice a year you can go to urgent care without getting permission in advance and get the care you need. Most of these places are open late, also on weekends, so you can get the care you need when you need it, and we tried to make that much easier. We also now have the nurse advice line, which is something we're very excited about. The nurse advice line is a 24/7 service. available nationwide to any military beneficiary, any of those 9.4 million people, and they can call that line 24/7, talk to a registered nurse who will give them medical advice. They can talk about what their problems are from a medical standpoint, what symptoms they're having. And, you know, we find that actually a large number of the callers are calling about children who have medical issues. And the nurse advice line can both provide medical advice and can also help the person determine what they should do next, where they should go to an emergency room, maybe go to an urgent care center, or if there's something they can do at home to take care of the problem in the short term. And the nurse advice line has access to appointments, and they can help make an appointment with a military doctor for that patient the next business day.
Could you tell us when these changes are going to take place, and if whatever the date is, what would I notice about it if I am a enrollee in TRICARE, a customer?
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you the two things I just talked about, both the nurse advice line and the urgent care pilot, are both in effect right now. The nurse advice line has been up and running now for about a year, but we continue to enhance it. We recently made some changes to make it better in terms of making sure that people can get referred to the care they need. And the urgent care changes took effect May 23rd. So far, that's going very well. We've gotten very positive feedback on that. So those two things are up and running. And then, as I said, for the new TRICARE contracts, you know, we can't do anything with those until November. Once those protests are resolved, whenever that happens, there is then a 9-month transition period after that, so that we expect that the TRICARE contracts probably will take effect sometime next year. That's our goal, but we'll have to wait and see on that. What I would say, though, and I really want to emphasize, is that while we're waiting for that to happen, the current TRICARE contracts remain in effect. We can extend those if we need to, so there will be no disruption in anyone's care. Currently, the way people get care through the military system is in place and is not going to change until we can get those new contracts up and running.
Are there benefits that people are missing out on because they don't understand how TRICARE works?
I think to some degree that's probably person-specific, but yes, I think there are some things that people may not be fully aware of. I think there's a couple areas I would mention there. One is that we offer a lot of preventive benefits, and most of our preventive benefits come without any copay. They're fully covered. Everything from, for example, screening mammographies, colonoscopies, vaccines. So the types of things that people may not be thinking about because they're not the kinds of things you use when you're sick. They're things that help keep you healthy. And we have a very broad coverage for preventive services that I think people don't always use as much as they could. So I think that's one major area. I think another area that we have available that perhaps people don't get the full benefit from sometimes is case management, where if you do have a chronic condition, we can assign you a case manager, someone who follows your care, works with your doctors and your nurses to help make sure you're getting the services you need. If you need to see, you know, several different types of doctors, they make sure the care is coordinated between them. And I think that's another benefit that we offer that sometimes people don't utilize as much as they could.
What is TRICARE doing to help patients have more access to their own health data? And what kind of data do people need to kind of take more control of their own health care?
Sure. I think we're doing several things. We have, as you may know, we have started the rollout of an electronic health record, a brand new state-of-the-art electronic health record. The first hospital where we'll be rolling that out is actually in Oak Harbor, Washington, at the Naval Hospital there, and that's going to be then a process as we roll this out across the country. I think that's a big change. We're also, in terms of what people need, I think we're also putting much more information out about the quality of the care provided within our military treatment facilities. You can now go to TRICARE.mil and click on the button there, and you can bring up information about every military hospital in the country and see a lot of information about the type of care they provide, what their results are, what their outcomes are. So it gives patients a lot more information so they can make good choices about their medical care. And we're very excited about that. That just started a few months ago, and that's a big plus. We're also working with healthcare information exchanges. For example, in the Colorado Springs area, many of the civilian hospitals we work at are tied into what we call a healthcare information exchange, where we can actually see the records generated by that those private hospitals for our patients. And the private doctors, when they're treating one of our patients, can see the information that's contained within our systems as well. And there's a lot of security with that. It's very closely monitored. But when that patient is going between the military system and the purchase care system, there's a much freer flow of information, which I think is very important to make sure they get consistent, high-quality care.
You were commanding officer at Oak Harbor, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Very good.
So I'm very proud that they're the first ones.
Absolutely. Is there, and pardon my ignorance in this, what's the difference, or is there any overlap between VA services and the TRICARE?
Sure. Yes, there is overlap between the VA and TRICARE, and I think that's very important to note. You know, the VA largely treats veterans who have service-connected disabilities. Doesn't have to be, but that's mostly who they treat. But we certainly send some of our patients to VA hospitals. For example, VA hospitals often have excellent centers for patients with traumatic brain injuries and neurotrauma, and we use those facilities extensively, and we even sometimes send active duty patients there as part of their recovery and rehabilitation. We also are able to share medical information now with the VA in a way we did not do before. So, for example, as a military doctor, I can get on the military's electronic health record system, the existing one. This will also be true with the new one, but even with the existing one, and I can see the VA records, and they can see my records, too, if they're treating one of our patients. So I think we do work very closely with the VA. Obviously, we're treating many of the same patients, and we learn from each other. You know, they have centers of excellence, for example, in post-traumatic stress disorder, and we've learned a lot from them, and we work very closely with them.
Well, I guess TRICARE and the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program are the two largest group health plans in the nation, with 8 to 9 million people in each one. Is the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, FEHBP, is that TRICARE in uniform?
No, it's actually somewhat different. The Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, essentially what that does is it gives you that gives federal employees a choice of various different insurance companies who offer plans that have different levels of benefit. On the other hand, what TRICARE does, TRICARE provides a uniform benefit. So all of our beneficiaries get basically the same benefits, the same things are covered. And the cost does vary a little bit if you're a family member or a retiree, and also depending on if you're in our HMO plan, which we call TRICARE Prime, and enrolled to a military treatment facility, or if you're in what we call TRICARE Standard, which means you can basically use any TRICARE authorized provider you wish. So there are some differences in the charges, but the basic benefits in terms of what types of things are covered, where they're covered, that is the same for all of our beneficiaries, which is very different than the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan.
And finally, you're moving to two regions instead of the current three. Why that move, and what will that regional shift mean for beneficiaries who are moving from one place to another?
Sure, and that's a great question. You know, right now you're correct. We have three regions, north, south, and west, and each one is managed by a different what we call managed care support contractor, essentially a large health insurance company that helps us manage the care, makes arrangements with civilian providers to make sure our patients get great care, and monitors the quality and those sorts of things. We're switching from three regions to two, and basically what we're doing is we're combining what are now the north and south regions into what we call an east region. The west region will stay essentially the same. And although there's a little bit of variation, by and large, the west region is west of the Mississippi River. The east region will be east of the Mississippi River. One of the big pluses for that is that when a person switches from one region to another, they do have to re-enroll with the new insurance company. They have to get new providers, that sort of thing, which has been, that's an administrative hassle, frankly. By going to two regions instead of three, we're going to reduce that. We'll have more consistency. If a person moves, say, from New York to Florida, they'll still be in the same region. They'll have the same company taking care of their care, and it'll be much less hassle for that individual. So I think from the beneficiary standpoint, when that happens, and that will happen, sometime next year when we start the new contract, when that happens, I think the beneficiaries will see a significant improvement in terms of the amount of administrative things that have to happen for them to get their care.
Captain, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Fascinating show. We'll see you here next Wednesday, we hope. Have a good week.